17. Return to Norwich. If the BBC thought I was going to sit around waiting for them to mull over a second series, or have yet more meetings, or conclude a criminal investigation into a man's death, they had another thing coming. If a shark stops moving, he perishes. If I stop broadcasting on the TV or radio, well, I don't know what happens, because I've never let it come to pass. Probably not death, but something pretty unpleasant, like glandular fever or the mumps. I needed to work. I approached Nick Peacock, then head of Radio Norwich, at a charity gypsy fight. Nick's a larger-than-life character, but I saw him as a heck of an admirable guy. He was beset by hygiene issues, but his indomitable spirit and enormous wealth had enabled him to achieve a marriage. "It's true what the Bible says," I mused to myself on their wedding day. "Beauty really is only skin deep. I mean, Carol Smiley is beautiful, but blanks me every time she sees me, and has a habit of tutting when I speak. Meanwhile, Anne Diamond is one of the nicest people I've met." So I was pleased that even Nick could find someone. It reminded me of the relationship between Catherine Zeta-Jones, incredibly beautiful, and Michael Douglas, looked like a grey crow. Anyway, Nick was helming Radio Norwich and had always been a pretty solid guy. So, in between bouts, Nick and I found a quiet corner of the warehouse, and I broached the subject of returning to Radio Norwich in a role over and above and away from my erstwhile sports brief. Sports reporting had been fun. I think I mentioned the evening I spent with Gunnell, but my horizons had broadened. People now looked to me to provide a much fuller broadcast experience. Merely providing award-winning snippets of sporting headlines would have left them short-changed and angry. No, I'd lanced the all-rounder bubble, and the pus of mainstream acclaim had been all that it emitted. Any sport that had been around had scabbed up and dropped off. I said to him, "Nick, what can I do?" He said, "What do you want?" Bloody hell, I thought. This is ideal. Nick wants me to do it. The listeners want me to do it. I want to do it. "Oh, I'm not sure the listeners want you to do it," he said. I thought it out loud. "But tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out." It was a refreshing attitude. I agreed to re-sign, not resign, re-sign there and then. Listeners are important, certainly, but automatically placing them on some kind of raised plinth or pedestal is tiresome. Sometimes people need to put the DJs first. Nick was ballsy. He'd been in charge of the big revamp at Radio Norwich, which to the naked eye comprised of a new aluminium handrail by the steps and a slightly bigger sans-serif font on the signage. He said there was much more to it than that, and said he'd overseen a major organisational restructure, which I wouldn't understand. "Try me," I said, and he reeled off some highfalutin corporate speak, which I won't bore you with now, but which I did understand. There were still plenty of familiar faces at Radio Norwich, and I was confident I'd be welcomed back by the guys there. No one had had a problem with me when I left the station back in 1991. In fact, I'd seen some of them in bars and restaurants in Norwich during my chat show heyday, and I'd frequently arranged for a glass of wine and an autographed napkin to be sent over, which I'd then acknowledge with a smile and a nod. That was something I didn't have to do, but I did it because at the end of the day, I'm a good guy. As my mother used to say, it's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice. FYI, she was neither. Don't get me wrong, I knew there'd be the odd snide comment from people who think that a 2.5-hour radio show 5 days a week is, I'm laughing as I write this, somehow a step down from presenting a half-hour TV talk show once a week. 12.5 hours of weekly output versus 0.5 hours? But there are idiots in all walks of life. No, I wasn't worried about being welcomed back into the fold. Employees at a London radio station like LBC or Radio London or London FM might have been a bit sniffy about it, but people in Norwich are warmer of heart than their bitter London counterparts with their negative equity and their stab wounds. No, I wasn't worried about being welcomed back into the fold. I was fully prepared to be the big man and chat to each employee individually to ensure that there were no hard feelings. So I made sure I sidled up to each member of the team in the kitchenette, outside the labs, jogging after them in the car park. I was making the effort and it paid off. At the end of each of these conversations, I said, "Right, point blank, do you like me?" And they all said yes. It was good to be back. I was pleased that I wasn't making television programs. I was happy. This was good and I liked it. In short, I was glad to be back working in the radio station I'd been at 5 years earlier. Had things changed at Radio Norwich in the time I'd been away? Not a great deal. While a few of the faces were different, the people who owned them were the same. By that I mean the intervening years hadn't been kind. For example, the girls on reception had sagged in the jowls a little, and whilst I'd flirted with them in the past, it didn't seem appropriate any more. But apart from the onset of ageing, I was pleased that the ethos, the spirit, and the playlist of Radio Norwich were exactly the same. Nick and I fell out shortly afterwards. I'd asked for and been given the breakfast show. Done deal, shake of hands, my press release written. So when, just a couple of days before launch, I bumped into the incumbent Breck Jock, a journeyman DJ called Dave Clifton, outside Odd Bins, I commiserated in that hollow, plastic way that passes for friendship in the media. "Bad break, mate," I chirped. "Good luck in what remains of your career." Dave frowned as he loaded his cans into the boot of his car and claimed he wasn't going anywhere, mate. I told him I'd been given the breakfast show, and he sniggered in a way that made me want to thump him in the guts. "Depends what time you eat breakfast," he laughed and drove away, wine bottles clinking in the boot like the laughter of a glass-throated child. Nick, his skin now cloaked in a bumpy rash as a result of work-related stress and a wholly inadequate hygiene routine, had reneged on his deal, rendering him dead to me then and always, and had slotted me into an early morning show. Providing classic hits, news, weather and chat from 4:30 to 7 a.m. was by no means a bad gig, but it wasn't the flagship vehicle I'd been dangled. I confronted Nick in a corridor and told him he was making a massive mistake. "You're making a massive mistake," I said. He mumbled something about upsetting the listeners and scurried off, but I followed him down the corridor. "The listeners, remember what you said? Tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out." I'd followed him to Studio 2, bamboozling him by placing the emphasis on a different word each time and continued bellowing it for a while before I'd realised that Emily Boyce was in there doing the weather. She covered the microphone and said, "Do you mind?" Realising my error, I gasped a sexual swear word. Although still hoarse with anger, I must admit I was deeply embarrassed by that. But I'm pleased to say, Emily and I became firm friends, and I never dropped the fuck bomb over her bulletins ever again. Nick and I are no longer close. In fact, I was delighted when I learnt that he wasn't invited to Fernando's wedding. I wasn't either. He left the station with a stress-related illness, and I'm glad. I'm told that he's lost a lot of weight, but at a rate that made you think twice about complimenting him on it because it was more likely to be the consequence of a serious illness. Again, glad. Up with the Partridge, again the name Alan's show was vetoed by people who think they know my output better than I do, proved to be nowhere near as depressing as expected. To be fair, the demographic was a real melting pot. Farmers, taxi drivers, new mums at their wit's end, fishermen, late-night returning ravers, and the disturbed people for whom darkness brought only despair. That gave the show a really spontaneous feel. On my insistence, we conducted audience research using a survey that I designed, which turned out to be chock-full of insights and learnings. In fact, the findings directly shaped my show. With the majority of Norfolk owning or having access to a telephone, it seemed utter folly not to build the show around a phone-in feature. Similarly, we learnt that a daily feature in which we asked aviation fans to call in with sightings of RAF training exercises was causing distress to the families of servicemen and consternation among RAF top brass, who argued that it had serious security implications. I thought that was a bit precious, but after 18 months, Scramble was quietly dropped. This was agile, responsive radio, and I was its pioneer. I began to fall in love with broadcasting all over again. And in a funny, kooky, zany kind of way, I think it fell in love with me again, too. I may have been back at the exact station in the exact same building at the exact same desk. The ergonomics needed work, but I was in no doubt that I was on a steep, upward career trajectory. Helming my own show with neither the limitations of a sports-only remit nor the self-serving irritation of studio guests was a challenge as new and fresh as an egg salad. This time, I set the agenda. It was me and my personality. And as I've been blessed with a superb personality, it translated into shit-hot radio. For the first time, I was also at the controls when it came to selecting music. I knew that soundtracking my listeners' early mornings was a major responsibility. Music is a powerful emotional catalyst, and research suggests that people are the most irritable between 5 and 6 in the morning. I was playing with fire. If my listeners were anything like me, hearing a subpar song on the radio before breakfast could see them slamming cupboard doors in the kitchen, scrubbing themselves down with body wash a bit too aggressively, or shouting at the assistant on the car phone. And I was buggered if my music was going to damage cupboard hinges, torso skin, or car phone cradles, all of which I value enormously. The knowledge that I was the conductor of my listeners' mood saw me jamming up on what quality music meant. I'd spend hours in HMVs, Virgin megastores, and second-hand record shops, staffed by greasy-haired 40-year-olds dressed as 20-year-olds, listening to contemporary music of every genre. Brit rock, heavy maiden, gang rap, breakbeat. And I came to a startling but unshakable conclusion. No genuinely good music has been created since 1988. The relief was, as Americans say, freakin' awesome. The death of music, on or before the release of Arthur II on the Rocks, meant I was freed from the obligation of keeping up to date with contemporary music trends. Instead, I could continually revisit music that embodied an era of Thatcher, hot hatches, and men who looked like girls. Bowie, Strange, Le Bon, Ant. Not of And Deck fame. I also knew I couldn't just play music and read out the song title and artist. I wasn't Mark Goodyear, for goodness sake. I needed to speak good as well. Having learnt a lot from my time in London and on TV, I knew if I was going to be the very best disc jockey there was, I couldn't rest on these considerable laurels. After all, Caesar didn't rest on his, he wore them on his head. Same with Adrian. Would he have built his fantastic wall had he been sat on the aforementioned decorative headwear? I think not. I wasn't nervous. People thought I was nervous, but I wasn't nervous. Nervous of what? So, not nervous. I just knew I had to put the graft in. And what graft? I'd shadow my colleagues, sitting in on other shows to pick up tips, learn techniques, or take ideas wholesale, and on one occasion staying at the studio for 2 days straight, until I began to hallucinate during the traffic report of my third show without sleep and jumped into the bank of monitors to avoid a motorbike. I roped my assistant in as well, instructing her to scour long-wave radio for far-flung stations and then tape entire shows, pausing whenever a record was played, and then unpausing on the song outro, so that she could present me at the end of each week with an audio dossier of continental broadcast trends. Invariably, I didn't have the time to listen to them. Of course I didn't. But I know she enjoyed being involved, even if she could only tune into most long-wave stations by standing on a box and holding the radio out of an upstairs window. In summary, then, I was becoming a better all-round broadcaster day by day. This bit could be cut into a montage and set to music, like the training sequence in Rocky or Karate Kid, albeit with less physical exertion.